This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Happy holidays, Merry Christmas, and Happy Hanukkah to everyone, each and every one of you listeners. I thank you so very much for listening over this past year and for nearly 400 episodes also. It's because of listeners like you that we kind of keep this going. And it's also because of the Friends of the Magic Word who help support this podcast with their financial aid that particularly helps us keep going by funding some of our projects and the places we travel to visit with people, and also for paying for the Skype calls we have to make, and also for the hardware and software, etc. But this week, I also want to welcome the newest member of the Friends of the Magic Word, Mr. Thomas Moore from Leicester, England. Hi there, or hello. Thomas, thank you very much for being a friend of the Magic Word, and welcome. And we thank you for your support and for listening. And as I said, I want to thank all of you listeners also for tuning in each week and to listening to these podcasts. We are completing the end of the year here shortly. We've got one more yet to go before we round out the year, and it's going to be exciting, and I'll tell you about that as soon as we finish with this episode. But this week's podcast is going to be with a friend of mine, Bill Palmer, who is well known throughout the world, I expect, because of his Cups and Balls collection. And in fact, he has a website called cupsandballsmuseum.com where you can see many of the cups and balls from his collection. And I also, many years ago, along with a local magician here, John Starr, who was formerly an English resident, he and I had videotaped an interview and a tour of Bill's Cups and Balls collection here in Houston before that he had moved and had to store all the things. And so anyhow, he talks a little bit about that in his podcast as well. But that particular video back in 2006 is now posted on the website. It's about an hour long, and we sit down, do a little chat with Bill and talk about his collection. And then he walks us through and shows us some of the highlights and some of the more important pieces from his collection. And at that time, he had about 600 sets of cups and balls. That has about tripled now. So, and he's still collecting as well, but he gets into that later here in the podcast. Now, I do want to say that the reason we've kind of, I guess, postponed this. I've been wanting to talk with Bill for quite some time, and it's one of those things where that, you know, there are people in your own backyard and you kind of see all the time anyhow, and you just don't get around to actually talking to and having a really genuine conversation. And that was the case here with Bill, that I really have been wanting to sit down and chat with him for quite some time. And it wasn't until actually he was in the hospital, or he had just completed a heart operation, and I went just to visit with him. And whenever I did, we started talking about magic, as the topic kind of went that direction. And I said, you know, this would be a great thing for us to actually talk about for the podcast. And he said, well, you don't happen to have your microphone with you, do you? And I said, as a matter of fact, I do. I carry it with me almost everywhere. So I turned it on, and he gave me a mini magic lecture, kind of the type of lecture that he would give whenever he goes out, actually. So it's about the world's shortest lecture, and opens up then to Q&A. And so anyhow, that's exactly what we did. So as we got into this, it wasn't until our time was up and I left the hospital that I came home and was starting listening to this and starting to edit it, and realized we never even mentioned the words cups and balls. So there were so many other things that were fascinating that he talked about. And so I thought, well, I need to get hold of him again and specifically talk about the cups and balls, because I know a lot of people who are listening to this podcast don't listen through the website. And so you get it through iTunes and other ways of subscribing, and don't go and take a look at the content that I spend time putting onto the website. But I do encourage you this particular week to go to the website at themagicwordpodcast.com and to view the video. Take some time. I think you'll enjoy that, because it is a visual smorgasbord of wonderful, beautiful cups, and very enlightening conversation we have then as well. And so I encourage you to go there and watch the YouTube video. Now, we talk a little bit then about the status of his collection as it stands now, what he's doing with it, and what the disposition is going to be of it once that he has decided to pass this on. So that's going to be on the tail end of this podcast. So I'm going to introduce him now, so this way that you can hear the whole thing. But keep in mind that if you're wanting to hear him talk just about the cups and balls, it's going to be closer to the tail end of this podcast after about an hour into this. So let me introduce this week's guest, Mr. Bill Palmer, here on The Magic Word.
Hi, it's Bill Palmer here. I've been doing magic for, since I was about five or six years old, and now I'm 75. And magic was good to me. I've also been a musician for an equal amount of time. I used both careers, and I discovered that with that and another career I had in stand-up comedy, that there were some basic principles of all of these forms of entertainment, and specifically, in all forms of entertainment, that determined basically how much you could make at the job. I mean, think about this: you go to a music conservatory, you learn to play Vivaldi or Bach or some of these other people, but nobody ever tells you how to make people like you. They just tell you how to play the notes. What good does that do? If you want to play the notes, buy a record, buy a CD, buy an MP3. You'll get it played perfectly and you can listen to it all you want to. And the same thing is true of most stand-up comics and so forth. Think about this. There's probably some guy in your town that he may even be in the room tonight, so I'm not even going to mention his name, but some guy in your town that he gets booked more often than you do, he gets paid more than you get paid, assuming he's telling you the truth, and you just wonder how he does it, because he's horrible. You all know a guy like that. We all know these guys. And the worst thing you can do is to worry about that guy. Because if you worry about that guy, you become that guy. And that's something you cannot afford to do. Now, this is the world's shortest magic lecture. I'll give you the lecture. Namaste. And then I walk off stage. And there's total silence. So I walk back out and say, okay, evidently none of you here speaks Hindi. That's understandable. So I'll translate it for you. Namaste is usually thought of as being the traditional Indian greeting, meaning hello and goodbye and maybe shalom and a bunch of other stuff like that. But the real meaning of that word is, my soul greets your soul. Now think about that. Isn't that better than just hello or goodbye? My soul greets your soul. I was at a Korla Pandit concert. And Korla always opened his concert with Namaste. Korla was the first music act to be syndicated on national television. He played an organ and a piano. They were set at right angles to each other so they could play both simultaneously. And he was amazing. Everybody loved the guy's music. He was what they call in England a one-off. He was totally unique. And I actually got to meet the guy in person, and I learned a lot about him. And I'm not gonna blow the whistle on Korla. There's nothing scandalous by any means, but just look him up on Wikipedia, Korla Pandit. You'll see what a good creator of a character he was. Anyway, I wondered why he used that as his opening. And then I found out what it really meant. I thought, oh, okay, well, that isn't that what an artist is supposed to do? Isn't he supposed to share his spirit with the audience? What happens when you share your soul with another person? They share theirs back with you. They make you're making a connection. You're making a deep spiritual connection. Now, this may sound like a lot of hooey and a lot of hogwash, but when you get right down to the absolutes on this, that's what an artist does. He presents his feelings, his soul, to the audience. Now, you can only do that one way, and that's by loving your audience. So your first thought when you get it there on the stage is how much you love your audience. Thurston used to do jumping jacks before the show, and he would say, I love my audience, I love my audience, as he did the jumping jacks. He was famous for that. You don't need to do all of that. Nobody ever said that working up a sweat made you more popular among other people. But remember, that was back in an earlier time, they didn't have deodorant. So it was...
It seems like I remember that the story was that he was peeking through the curtain to see his audience and was looking at individuals and saying, I love you, and I love you, and I love you. And he just kept saying it over and over as he was looking at everyone out there.
Yeah, that may be true. But the thing is...
You know, and a similar thing, just as an aside, whenever I go into a restaurant to work, my thought changes completely before I open that door. Mm-hmm. I put on a smile as I leave my car to walk towards the front door. Even if it's a false smile, I just intentionally smile as broad as I can. Mm-hmm. If somebody saw me, they'd think, what the heck did he just do, you know? But because it looks so silly. But nevertheless, I still try to have that attitude. So when I walk in the door, then I look like, I'm telling myself, I love these people. I love what I'm going to be doing, and I'm going to, you know, share something with them. So I intentionally put on a smile before I walk in the door.
Yeah, it makes good sense. It makes good sense. So I explain this. I go into a lot of detail on things to do and things not to do. I also work in a lot of typical theater lore, like, for instance, never whistle backstage. Mm-hmm. Why don't you whistle backstage? For the same reason that they only have one piccolo in a marching band. It carries through the whole...
Everybody can hear it.
Everybody can hear it. You can hear that out front. That's one of those things. Don't bounce stuff around backstage. People can hear it.
Like a basketball or something.
Yep, exactly. And
don't use the word Macbeth.
Pardon? Yeah, don't don't refer to Macbeth. That's the.
I don't understand that one.
Well, it's because every time anybody did that back in Shakespeare's day, there was a tragedy at the theater. Hmm. So they just now call it the Scottish play. And if you are a novice performer and you say Macbeth, you have to go outside, turn around three times, spit over your shoulder, and walk back in.
Hmm. Okay.
Markham did that to... Kevin Thompson, who was one of my assistants at Scarborough. And it was kind of funny watching him revive that old thing. But I go through that, and I say the main thing is, first, you have to break down the barriers that may exist between you and your audience. And the first thing is this. It's how you look. One thing that I will tell you, whatever you do, do not grow facial hair. Actually, if you know how to compensate for being one of those who's gifted with luxurious facial hair, I won't mention any names, of course, but you will understand that it can be an attribute that smacks of success. And
help John Calvert.
Sure. Yeah. Well, a waxed mustache brings more approval than one that just goes... You know, it changes the way that people react to you. I said, avoid obscene tattoos. not a good idea. You know, you don't want to have... And this is especially if you're a birthday party magician.
Okay.
You know, don't laugh. I've seen this.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
And I said, these are some of the points. Make sure that your props look like they weren't just stored in a warehouse for 30 years. And I know they're original fare and they're collectible and all that. But if you're going to work with them, then make them look decent, because they're not going to be as original as they were when you bought them once you finish tearing them up on the stage. So, you know, keep your props clean. Make sure your costume is clean. And make sure it fits you as well as it can when you have 40 doves stuffed in various parts of your anatomy. And likewise, remember that people do not always really think of magic as anything more than a puzzle. Part of your idea of sharing your spirit with them is to fascinate them. It's to give them the idea of touching their soul. Punks used to talk about this in his books. So did Borodin. These guys were more interested in making spiritual contact than anything else. And they really, really, really understood how to do that. Look at your whole act as a total artwork. It's not an original idea. Wagner actually came up with a concept. He called his operas and compositions Gesamtkunstwerk, which means a total artwork, total work of art. And he even designed and invented musical instruments specifically to get a certain sound. He designed a theater in Bayreuth that has the entire symphony underneath the stage so that the singers can be heard over the symphony. Weird, huh?
That is strange, yeah.
Yeah, okay. But the blend is what makes it magical.
Okay.
And, he designed all the props for that, including a flame-throwing articulated dragon.
Wow.
Yep. I mean, just all this strange stuff. You talk about a man who was a supreme artist. Now, granted, he was an anti-Semite, and there's no forgiving him for that. But still, he was a hell of an artist. And so I at roughly at this point, I go in for questions.
Okay, it is a short kind of a lecture.
Yeah, it is, but yeah. It ends up lasting an hour, it's an hour and a half.
With the Q&A.
Yeah, with the Q&A.
Well, let me just do a little Q&A.
Okay.
Then I agree with what we were just talking about as far as loving your audience. I think it's interesting how that there is a group, I think, in any art, whether it's in music or in movies or television or whatever, that is they're the A artists, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking like in magic, you know, that Matt King or Lance Burden, Johnny Thompson, I mean, sure. People whose names, you know, you magicians know. The ones below them, I mean, there's a big gap between A artists and B artists.
Right.
What do you think can tighten that gap or make a B person more of an A?
Well, it's hard to say, because you have to understand why someone chooses to be a B person.
Hmm.
Now, this is...
That's interesting. So it could be an intentional selection. Intentional.
Yeah. I had a chance when I was working in music to jump from being the guy that played at the pizza parlors.
Okay.
To the guy that played with a good road band. That was about 1975 or
so. You're working Shakey's Pizza Parlor, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm. And the thing was that everybody made fun of the Shakey's Pizza Parlor magicians because, I mean the musicians at Shakey's Pizza Parlor because, I mean, you're working at a pizza parlor, man, big deal. What they didn't realize is we got paid as much money as the guy who was working One Shell Plaza, and we worked more nights, mm-hmm. and we had more doubles. So we were actually getting paid more than the guys who were working the really classy places.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there was that. I had a guy that tell me, you know, I've got this great gig, man. I get paid X number of dollars a week. I have basically no taxes because...
They pay in cash?
It was one of these deals where his room came off the top. So did his traveling. And by the time he depreciated everything down, there was nothing left. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, that's all well and good, but see, I'd rather stay in one place and not have to hassle with all of that. A year later, he called me up and he said, man, he said, are you familiar with disco? I said, yeah. He said, well, it just killed my act. It used to be that we would drive maybe 100 miles to get to the next town. Now we drive 500 miles and we're absolutely worn out when we get there. And we have all these other hassles. Can you get me some pills? I said, you know, I don't have any sources for that kind of stuff. He says, come on, man, you're bound to. I said, no, I had too much to risk. And he said, wow. Well, sorry about that. And I said, man, I am too. I sure wish you hadn't invested so much in what you're doing. There is a step that you have to take at some point. It's where you make a total commitment, mm-hmm. an absolute total commitment to what you're going to do, where you're willing to sacrifice everything you've got to do it. And that's why some people, you and I both know, mm-hmm. will never make the step because they won't give up the day gig.
There was a movie recently, and I don't know if you've seen that, that's called The Magicians, The Hidden Something or Other. I forget. It was a documentary.
Yeah.
And they covered four different magicians. If a person is watching that, some people might think, gee, that's pretty sad, you know, that this person is trying this hard and not being successful. But if you look at it actually from the standpoint of exactly that, how hard they're working in order to make it to that next step, that they're willing to give up, you know, certain things in order to get the experience that will lead them to something else, mm-hmm. and get better opportunities. In other words, if you were to look at a documentary, let's say, of a dancer who was working in Broadway, or rather trying to get on Broadway and working off Broadway, and all the hours that the dancers have to spend, you know, just practicing, and then might get a part somewhere off Broadway to be the person in the back you never even see.
Yeah.
But they're getting the same kind of a thing and a commitment that they're doing during the daytime when they're not rehearsing, that they're having to make a little bit of money as a waiter or waitress someplace doing something. And the same way here with these magicians. But if you look at it from that standpoint, it is the art that you need to die for.
Yeah, that's it. And it's like, I won't mention the guy's name. He's someone that everybody around here knows. But I told him, I said, you know, you have potential to be a really, really great magician. But it's not going to happen until you give up your day gig. And he had a day gig that was really fantastic. He couldn't afford to give it up. Mm-hmm. And he said, but I'm as good as anybody out there. I said, yes, you are, but you're not committed. And he started describing to me one thing he was going to do at a trade show. Now, it was a very brilliant trick, very brilliant routine, but it was going to take him 10 minutes to do the routine, and it was going to take him probably $3,000 or $4,000 to just set it up. Hmm. Now, that's great if you're going to be able to use it on some other show, but if you're not going to be able to use it on some other show, you've just wasted all that time and money.
But if he was making good money in a different career, first of all, that's not going to matter that much. And number two is that they're paying you a lot at a trade show,
yeah.
and so it would be self-liquidating. I mean, it'd pay for itself even if you're not going to use that again.
Sure, yeah, exactly. But the thing is that keeps them from getting that polish.
Oh, because you're not doing it.
Because you're not doing it all the time.
The difference between an amateur and a professional.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You got to get that polished. You know, it takes... It takes an immense amount of dedication to get something polished. And there's no way to do it but get out there and polish it yourself.
Yeah.
And that's it, you know. It's.
Yep, that's a good point. Yeah. Well, you worked for years, of course, then, and you mentioned the Scarborough Fair recently. which is a Renaissance fair. But you work the RenFest, the Renaissance Festival here in Houston or north of Houston, annually for 25 years. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 26. As Merlin, and then you went over to the UK sometimes, and you worked. Yeah. I think Markham worked over there as well.
Yeah, from time to time. All I did in the UK was lectures. I didn't do any formal show. Well, I did one formal show, but it was connected with the lecture. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
Well, in developing that character, did they specifically, I mean, I suspect you were doing some other kinds of characters like that, like at the Madrigal Dinners or something here. But
I did a few of those. I did the Dickens on the Strand thing, and it was the same basic character, just a different costume and a few different lines, but they were lines that fit well. And it was all just a matter of knowing how to fit your character into the story. And you had to know your character. See, this is the other thing. A lot of people never develop a character. They think, well, they're coming to see me. No. They're not coming to see you. They're coming to see the person they think you are.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, if you fail to create the character that either has no flaws or whose flaws are amusing and acceptable, you will be a much greater success than you will be if you're, say, Harvey Weinstein.
Okay.
Right? Okay?
Yeah.
And it's like I used to tell my magic students when I was doing magic classes, I'd say, I want you to imagine that you are in your lowest point as a human being. You're sitting in front of the television set in an undershirt and cut-off jeans with a case of beer next to you, and you're watching the Super Bowl. How many people do you know that would pay to see that? And they all agreed that nobody would pay to see that, because everybody can do that.
Right.
So I said, you have to get rid of all of those elements. And the ones you can't get rid of, you have to make them things people want to see.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's basically it.
Well, there are people, of course, who play the Merlin character in other Renaissance festivals around the world. And you've probably seen several of those, good, bad, or indifferent.
Yeah.
And did you ever give any advice to anybody? And if not, what kind of advice would you give to somebody who would be wanting to take on that role?
There was one guy who said, if I catch you doing Merlin at my festival again, I'll break your neck. But no, seriously, I would tell him, if you're going to do this, make sure you're doing it where nobody else is doing it.
Because there should only be one Merlin.
There should be only one Merlin.
But what about other magicians? But
other magicians say, becoming Merlin the magician can be great for you, but it can also have its negative aspects. One of them is you got to figure out who you are when you're Merlin and who you are when you're not Merlin.
So were you able to separate that?
Yeah.
Because you worked for how many, like, what was that, 8 weeks, I guess, out of the year in the RenFest?
Well, I worked a total of 16 when I worked both of them.
Okay.
And I'd kept that in a particular frame of reference. But when I was doing trade shows, I couldn't do Merlin. That was not what they wanted. They wanted something else.
You were in a coat and tie then?
Yeah, I'd wear a coat and tie. Mm-hmm. And I was a different character. I did have a roving gambler that I worked, if that was on demand, of course.
Well, it would seem that you did Merlin more often than you did trade shows.
That's what you saw me do.
Right.
Yeah, and I did some Christmas parties as Merlin and some other corporate things as Merlin, but I would say I did an equal amount as one of my other characters. I had a really good comedy show. One of the things that they liked about me at the Laugh Stop was that I always did time. If they wanted 18 minutes and 60 and 35 seconds. They got 18 minutes and 35 seconds. Mm-hmm. And I didn't use a watch.
Wow.
Yeah.
You had rehearsed it enough that you had the timing down.
I could feel it. I could actually feel it. Mm-hmm. And I never got the light.
So you were able to rehearse such that you would make time for laughter and applause.
Exactly. Right? Mm-hmm. In fact, I had a real sore spot about people that ran over, especially at Renaissance festivals, because sometimes we were doing continuous shows mm-hmm. on a specific stage. And so this is especially true of Scarborough Fair. So I'd go out 2 days before the show, and I'd start loading my stuff in the backstage area. And there'd always be a new act up there rehearsing their material. And when they'd finish, and when I was finished, they'd go up and say, "Hi, I'm Merlin." I said, "Well, we're so-and-so." I said, "Great, how long is your show?" "Oh, it's about 35 minutes. Let me rephrase that. How long is your show?" "Well, it's about 35 minutes. Have you ever timed your show?" "Well, no." I said, "Okay, you've got a 30-minute time slot to fill. If you run over, you're not going to be very popular around here, and you will not be hired back." They said, "Oh." I said, "I would suggest now that you practice, that you run through your act just like you were going to do it, and time it." "Oh, okay." So they would run through their act. They'd come back and say, "Well, our act is 33 minutes. I say, "Okay.
Getting close."
"Now, let me explain what you need to do. You need to throw out the weakest 3 minutes of your act." "Well, we don't have any 3 minutes that are weak." I said, "Oh, I beg to differ with you. I've heard your act 5 times now. Would you like me to point them out?" "Oh, well," so they would do that. And then they'd say, "Well, okay, we've got it down to 30 minutes. I said, "Okay, now there's just one other thing. You need to add 5 minutes for setup, and you need to also take some time out in the unlikely occurrence that there's actually audience response and applause." Mm-hmm. Of course, now I was being as big a butt as I could. But there was a reason for this. I was a seasoned performer, and these guys were so wet around their ears that they were dripping on the stage, you know. So they would finally get it down and said, "Now, I do want you to understand that if you run over on me, you will, the first time, I will just let you know that you run over on me. The second time, you will never, ever, ever do it again. Why? You'll see. And I know you'll see." So they go out the first day, and the first show, they'd run it exactly 30 minutes. And I'd say, "Okay, you ran over, because you got to give me a chance
to get set up,
to get my stuff set up. And my act takes 20 minutes, not including setup and takedown." "Oh." So the second show, they would get up there and they'd do the show. And at 30 minutes, I would walk out during their hat pass.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And start setting up your stuff.
I'd start setting my stuff up. And I'd say, "Ladies and gentlemen, don't mind us. Just continue to watch them. We'll be starting in 5 minutes, all right?" And they'd go to the entertainment director. Mm-hmm. And the entertainment director would say, "Well, I'm sure he told you that he had permission to do that." "Well, yes, he did. You should have listened to him."
Did that tighten it up?
It tied it up, yeah.
No, I mean, it tightened up so that way thereafter didn't have a problem.
Sure, yeah, it did. It was the way, you know.
What about over the 25 years? You had to have had some funny things that had happened.
Oh, yeah, I had a lot of them.
Like?
Well, okay, I'll tell you one that was one of them happened when you were there. Traditionally, on the last weekend of the festival, the assistants will try to screw the show up.
Oh, I remember those.
Yeah, and I was doing that Marlin show where I had the Assistant's Revenge at the end, and I came in from the back of the crowd. We did that disappearance. Well, there was the Johnny Thompson bowling ball production, mm-hmm. which I'd gotten permission from Johnny to do. And at the end of that production, instead of putting the bowling ball in the rig, they'd put this gigantic gourd. I couldn't fire him. It was the last show. The show was getting ready to change completely after that anyway. But it was funny. But it was okay. I feel like I've given birth to a bowling ball. Well, I'm close.
So the melon, did it break open?
No, I didn't drop it.
Okay.
I didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
But
what about volunteers you've had up on stage?
Oh, man. Well, I'll tell you, I learned to cut them off early.
Because they drink a lot out there.
Yeah, I was getting ready to, this is about the third year I was out there. Castle stage at the back of the thing, and this guy comes and sits down in the front row, and he says, let's sit down here so we can hassle the magician. That's what they're for.
Okay.
So I just leaned down and I said, no, sir, that's not what we're for. If you think you're going to hassle me and get away with it scot-free, you are absolutely wrong. Because if you start giving me trouble, I'll call security and they'll take you to the front gate and throw your butt out. And he said, you're serious? I said, damn right I am. And he got up and left.
Because they were there specifically to hassle you.
Yeah, exactly. Hmm. Now, the thing is, I didn't have a security guard there. Hey, if I could tell them that that something disappeared when it went up my sleeve, then there certainly could. I realize that's a brutal tactic, but sometimes a brutal tactic is the one that works.
Yeah.
When you're talking about drunks, that's what you have to do.
You know, I have asked.
Oh, and they could not hear me out in the audience. It was just between me and him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was that just before the show or as it began?
Just before the show started.
Well, and speaking of selecting volunteers, I've had this discussion with a lot of guys I've chatted with over the years, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on how that you go about selecting the volunteer to make sure that you get the right one, you know, that you don't want the person that's pointing to somebody else, you know, or that is too shy or one is too eager. How do you develop that selection process and get the right person?
Well, you have to go by what you need them for. For instance, if you're doing a book test, you have to have someone who reads.
I had someone who couldn't tell time, you know, and I showed him the watch, and he said, well, I can't read that kind of watch.
Uh-huh, sure.
Wow.
Yeah. So the easiest cue for that is, do they wear glasses?
Okay.
Usually if they wear glasses, they can read.
A young person in particular, not an older person, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay.
I had a book test that I published it actually. It was based on the David Hoy test, and I used it at bookstores and libraries because you could use what was there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just walk in and you pick up a few books and you get the information you need, and then you walk over to the counter and you ask one of the people that works there, are you going to be in watching the magic show today? Good. Would you take these three books with you? Did you see me pick these up out of the counter? You did. Good. Did I have a chance to read all three of them?
No.
And all of that, you know. Say, just guard these with your life. Well, not necessarily with your life, but make sure you get the and you sit in the front row. Now, this was at the Cleveland Public Library. I did a show for them every year for about a dozen years.
That's Cleveland, Texas.
Yes. And I always liked to do it. It was a reward for their summer reading program. Now, I had never used a book test for a children's audience. But I thought, you know, this is a special group of kids. And they know me. And I'll just save the newspaper till last, so that if it doesn't work, I can do the book. I can clean up with the newspaper. So I said I'd like to bring up the person who read the most books this summer. Who is that? And it was a kid about, say, 14 years old, wore glasses. He passed all the tests, you know. And so I introduced myself to him, and I said, tell me what you see there on the table. He says, I see three books. I said, very good. Would you pick up two of the books, please? He did. And I said, hold one of them up in the air so everybody can see it. Good, we'll use that one. Here, I'm not going to do anything with this book. So, in fact, here, you take it. Guard it. And force the page. And then I had him go through the bit on the test. Of course, what I did was I looked for a book that had a blank page in it. Mm-hmm. And that was the page I forced.
Okay.
Okay. Now,
so you didn't have to worry about him reading or not?
Oh, no, you did. This was just the way you started the test.
Oh.
Okay. I figure, if you're going to make it look like you're reading a guy's mind, you don't want to go, you're thinking of the.
Okay.
You want to get some emotions into it. You want to get something that makes some sense. So I said, have you found the page? You have. Good. Would you look at it, please, and concentrate? I'm not getting anything. Have you ever done this before? You haven't? Oh. Well, I don't mean to be rude, but you're really not very good at it. Oh, wait a minute. Is that a blank page? Oh, of course. Well, you are better at it than I thought. And now the guy's relaxed.
Yeah.
And, okay, he's surprised now. So's the audience. So I say, turn to the next page. Does that one have writing on it? Now, here's the thing about books, especially anthologies. If there's going to be a blank page, it will be right before a new chapter.
Right.
So there'll be a heading, and there'll be some text. There has to be. Mm-hmm. And the text will always start with something that's somewhat interesting, unless it was written by John Bull or Lytton. It was a dark and stormy night. Anyway, so he looks at the page. I said, don't read it out loud. Just look at what you see on the page and picture it in your mind. Okay. This is strange. I'm seeing a word that doesn't happen very often in modern English, but it's fortnight. That means 2 weeks, doesn't it? Is there something about a fortnight there on that page? And the guy says, yeah. I said, there's a stairwell. A woman in a stairwell. She's wearing a business suit, a gray business suit. Does that make sense? Yes. Yes, it does. She doesn't have a name. She has initials. Is that right? Two initials, but I only see one. Does that mean they're the same? They are. Is her name JJ? And now the kid's going, wah, whoo, you know?
Yeah.
And so.
So it's better than just having one word. You're actually going for a visual image.
Yeah, you're going for something that people, you're going for the way people think. Mm-hmm. And then I say, now, would you look at the top of the page? And he said, I said, is there a phrase or a heading there? Of course there's a heading there.
Sure.
It's a chapter.
Yeah.
I said, just look at it, please. Though this is strange, I'm getting a feeling of loss and redemption. Does it say chapter 11?
Lost and Redemption. Funny. Okay, got it.
I got that.
They're bankrupt, by the way.
From Bob Carlbach.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
So anyway, that's the way I did the book test. I had other bits that I did with it, depending on what language I was doing it in, because I used to do that one in German too.
I was going to ask you about German, because you had translated a lot of books, English to German, German to English, and mm-hmm. spent some time over in Germany, and quite fluent, obviously, and friends with Punks and Ted Leslie and yeah. Borodin. And did those? I know that Ted Leslie did book tests. I mean, he was an excellent mentalist. Mm-hmm. How did you first meet him?
Well, my first trip to Germany was in 1990. And I had gone over to spend a week in Germany to meet Punks. Well, not to meet Punks, but to take him the translation of the second book. And then I was going to...
You've been corresponding back and forth, and how had he reached you to begin with?
Well, Craig Snader had got gotten me in touch with...
From Mexico City.
Yeah, with Punks. He'd acquired the rights to the Punks books. And Punks had come into Texas for a week, or 2 weeks, actually. And we took him to San Antonio so he could meet with John Cornelius and some of these other people. And then I flew to Germany and spent a week there, and then I spent a week in England, so I wanted to go to the Magic Circle since I paid my dues.
Did you remember?
Yeah, I needed to do that. So anyway, a guy named Peter Rückert, who was a friend of Punks's and who was the owner of the La Vienne Rose nightclub, which was the old officers club at Tempelhof Air Base, had now Tempelhof Airport, had invited me up to see his magic collection in Berlin. So I got to see Berlin right as the wall was coming down. It was quite exciting. And so as we were leaving, he says, "Is there anything else you would like to see?" And I said, "Yeah, I'd like to meet Ted Leslie." "And what do you want to meet him for?" "Well, I wanted to find out if all those horrible things that Punk said about him were true." So he takes me over to Ted's, and they were all true, every last one of them. Hmm. Just, he was everything that Punk said he was.
Like what?
He was gay, and he was egotistical, and he was somewhat conceited, arrogant even. But Punk's left out the most important part. He was charming. He was likable. He was generous to a fault, and he was a really, really nice man. And mm-hmm. that was what Punks had missed, because Punks was so frightened that somebody would be better than he was.
As a competitor.
As a competitor. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Punks had really quit performing, you know, and it was really unfortunate. But I spent about an hour over there, and he had the coins for scotch and soda sitting on his table, and he said, "I said, are you working on?" "No, it wasn't scotch and soda. It was the copper, silver, brass with the total vanish at the end."
Okay.
And that I had gotten from Paul Diamond. I said, "Are you doing that one?" He says, "Working on it." And I said, "Let me show you a little twist on it." And I had the shell, so I was ready to do it. I did it for him. And at the end, he said, "My God, that's amazing." I said, "I'll show you." And I showed him how to do it. He says, "That's marvelous." Well, he wrote a book that was never published. And in the end of it, he had a chapter about people that had influenced his life. And my chapter was about, he wrote a chapter about me. And he claimed that if I had not translated his book, he would not have achieved the fame he had in the United States. And I said, "Ted, you can't blame your success on me." Because I blame my success on you all the time. And I mean, we were very close.
You're quite close friends. I know he came over from time to time. I remember going to a Chinese restaurant with you guys. I think Banachek and you and I and Ted Leslie had gone to lunch. And he was in town. I think he made several trips over here. I believe that he was ill and spent some time in the med center from time to time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, this thing about Ted being gay was minor. It did not affect the way Ted interacted with people. Punks were just homophobic. And it was too bad because that got in the way of him liking Ted. Last conversation I had with Punks, he called up and he says, "That Ted Leslie is such a liar." I said, "What's wrong, Punks?" "He says his book has sold 15,000 copies. And that is impossible. How can his book sell 15,000 copies when our books have sold only 1,500 copies altogether?" I said, "Well," I said, "Snader only printed 15. "That gangster, don't mention his name in front of me," I said. "Now, wait a minute. Craig was not a gangster. He was just not a good businessman." He said, "Well, that Ted Leslie, he forgets everything I did for him." So I said, "No, he did not." And I went over and got the book, and I read what he said about Punks in it, about how Punks had showed him this and how Dagmar had showed him that and all that. And he said, "I should be ashamed of myself. I am a nasty old man." Hmm. I said, "You're right, Punks. You should be ashamed of yourself. You are a nasty old man. How's Dagmar?"
Now, was this after Ted had died?
No.
Ted was still alive at the time.
Yeah, Ted outlived Punks.
So did they kiss, well, not kiss and make up, but did they finally resolve their differences?
No, there's no way that could happen. Ted asked me one time, when we were doing that last tour through the country, he said, "Bill, how is it that a heterosexual man like you can be the best friend of a homosexual man like me?" I said, "Was it ever about that?"
It's right.
He says, "What do you mean?" I said, "There are women you like, right?" "Well, yes, of course. Everybody likes women." I said, "Well, some people like women more than other people do, but you're right. That's exactly the point." I said, "It was never based on anything sexual at all. It was based on the fact that we're friends." Mm-hmm. And that's
similar interests.
Yeah, similar interests and all that. And he says, "Oh, well, okay, never mind." And that was it. Mm-hmm. He never once tried to hit on me. Mm-hmm. But he did do something with me that was very funny. I was visiting him in Berlin. This is after the wall had come down, of course. And he asked me if I would go to a nightclub with him. It was in the old Eastern sector, because he was trying to get in with the artist community there, which was primarily gay men, and this is where they hung out. And he says, "I need for you to go with me, because I have told the bartender that you are my new lover," and this. And so.
So you're supposed to hold hands and go in there?
No, actually, the strange thing about that is in Germany, gays don't behave like that unless they have some kind of a chip on their shoulder. Hmm. It's not, I mean, even here they don't. I've got friends who are gay. I've got friends that have been married for a couple of years that you wouldn't know that they were gay. But, you know, it's funny. People tend to find people they don't really know as just one aspect of what and who they are. And when you do that, you turn off so many important things. I mean, Gene Berger was a friend of mine. Not a super close friend of mine, but we spoke to each other on a peer-to-peer level. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that I was as good a performer as Gene Berger. I'm just saying that we understood why we did things the way we did. And it wasn't a thing of questioning it. I remember the first time I talked to him on the phone, I said, "Oh, Gene, I got your new book." And I said, "You know, it's kind of funny. I think most of the people who buy this book will realize it's the same book you've already written three times. And he says, yeah. He says, I'm just trying to find new ways to word it. Maybe it'll catch on. And I said, isn't it that the irony of it? The people who need the book will buy it and not read it. And the people who don't need the book will buy it and keep it on their shelves. Mm-hmm. And he says, yeah. I said, I noticed that you had studied at a Lutheran seminary. He said, yes. I said, also noticed that you played the accordion. He said, yes. I said, did you ever think that there might be a similarity between my name and the accordion books you studied from? He says, what do you mean? I said, well, you studied with the Palmer Hughes accordion course, didn't you? He said, yeah, I did. Mm-hmm. I said, my dad wrote them. I said, don't hate me for that. But, you know, that was it. You know, it's like I misjudged Jeff McBride terribly because I'd see all of his ads, you know.
Right.
See all his puff pieces. Right. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, this guy's really conceited. No. If you know Jeff McBride, you know an entirely different person.
Exactly.
Very
nice guy.
2005, at the Magic Circle Centenary, we were down where they had that stage, you know, it was terrible.
I was there.
Yeah, I know you were. A terrible venue, because if you're in the back, that's where all the heat was. And Alan Saxon did his best to cool that place off. He really did. I gained a lot of respect for him on that. Anyway, there was a kid that I had run into who was trying to learn Twisting the Aces, and he showed me what he said. I said, that's pretty good. Let me give you a couple little hints here. And I explained what Vern's thinking was on certain parts of it and all that. And then I was walking into the audience, the auditorium, and here was Jeff with the, what's his wife's name?
Abby.
Abby. And I said, Jeff, this is David. And David is working on some, he's getting ready to go for the youth membership. He says, oh, really? Hey, David, show me something. Do something for me. Kind of coached him on some stuff, and mm-hmm. he was just really, he got into working with this kid, and then after he got through, and the kid's going,
yeah,
you know, he said, I said, Jeff, thank you for doing that. He says, I have to do that. I have to do that. We all have to do that. That's the future of this art.
He is always excited about magic, mm-hmm. and believes you should be a magician 24/7 and right. everything. And he will give, you know, unlimited time to anybody who is interested and asks,
exactly.
basically, without price. I mean, of course, he's got other kinds of things he does with the mystery school, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure.
But if there is someone who has a sincere interest or has a question or he's at a convention someplace, you know, when he's talking to you, it seems like you're the only person that exists, and he'll answer all of your questions and mm-hmm. give as much time and teach you whatever.
Sure. Well, I was in Vegas for one of the collector's conventions they did there. Ross Wandry and I went over to see the world's greatest magic show. And after the show was over, Paul Kozak said, hey, you guys want to go to Los Andres' birthday party? So we said, sure. Would it be a problem? No, it'd be great. And actually, I had already known about the party because I had a whole bunch of salt gimmicks that I was going to show to Los Andres, because he's working on a video about salt gimmick with Kozak. So I walk into the, here's Carol and me and Ross Wandry, and we walk into the front door, and Jeff McBride turns around and says, that guy is the man who defined the Merlin the Magician character at Renaissance festivals. I turned and looked to see who he was pointing.
Somebody else would walk in with
yeah.
him.
Yeah. And he says, and so I walked over and said, Jeff, it's nice to meet you. Thank you very much for your comments. I had no idea that you had even an inkling of who I was. Mm-hmm. And he says, oh, no, man. I know everything that's ever been written about you. Mm-hmm. I said, wow, I hope you saw the good stuff. But that was my first encounter with Jeff. And
Yeah, well, as I said, he's a teacher, but then you've been a teacher then also, mm-hmm. and the books that... have you ever written your own book? Again, you translated for others, but have you ever published? I don't think I have one of yours, if you do. Have you?
I've written a few lectures, but I haven't written a book.
That's what I meant. I mean a book as far as that goes. And you're, and when you've been teaching, you've just been kind of one-on-one classes?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I did classes for Leisure Learning Unlimited, and those were fun.
As have I. Speaking of that, I understand that Eugene Berger has a new book out. Called Teaching Magic, which also has, I think, pretty much sold out before it's even left the publishers. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering from what you just said then, the way he kind of rewrites and rehashes some of the same stuff, if this is another book like that.
I haven't done it. I had a very interesting experience with that, though. When I started teaching for Leisure Learning, I think it was the first or second set of classes, I had two magic courses and a memory course. And this lady called me up and told me what a wonderful magician her 13-year-old boy was. And she says, "Now I know you think I'm a stage mother, and I am, but this kid of mine is really good, and I've taken him to Wayne Reiki, and Wayne showed him everything he could take him to, but Wayne's kind of rough, you know." Mm-hmm. I said, "Yeah, but Wayne knows his onions." I said, I'll let him enroll in my classes, if that'll be enough." So I talked to him before the thing. I said, "Look, if you're a good magician and all this, you got to make sure that you don't offend the adults that are in the class, because if they think that you're a smart ass, they're not going to like you. Mm-hmm. And then you won't do much performing." And he said, "Okay." And he excelled. He was the only one that ever did all the assignments. Like, for instance, I had the first class that say, "Now, I want you to think of 10 ways of revealing a chosen card. I don't want you to think of methods. I want you to think of 10 places a chosen card could show up in, or something like that." And I said, "Here's an example. They raise the Titanic, and they go into the office of the captain, and they find the safe. They open it up, and on camera, when they open the safe door, the selected card is stuck to the safe door, and the corner that was torn off of it fits." And they said, "Wow, that's impossible." I says, "That's the whole idea. You don't have to worry about how it's done. Just come up with an idea that's that fantastic."
Sounds like a Berglas effect.
Well, almost. Jay did it. I figured out how to do it. I wouldn't do any... and if you come up with one that I can't explain, then I'll work on it an extra week. But I showed him different ways of doing stuff. The method on that was simple. Of course, you have to make sure the video is the right size to make the corner of the card fit. But it's just to have a video of a guy reaching into a safe, mm-hmm. with the same kind of piping on his sleeve that a captain would have, or that the same kind of a t-shirt on, or whatever the guy would have.
Just edit the video.
Just edit the video. And they say, "Oh, well, that's not fair." I said, "Nothing's fair in magic."
Yeah. You know, the effect is everything.
That's it.
Yeah.
But now here's the thing. 2 years ago, I get this phone call, and this guy says, "You probably don't remember me. My name's Jay Alexander." Mm-hmm. I said, "Sure, I remember you, Jay. How you been doing?" He says, "Man," he says, "I owe you my whole livelihood. What you taught me when I took those classes from you was what I've earned my living with for the last 30-some-odd years." Mm-hmm. "And I'm in town for a trade show. I just want to take you and your wife out to lunch."
Quite a testimony.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was so nice.
Yeah. He's a nice guy. Yeah, he's a good magician too. Yeah. Yeah.
But that he was my shining star.
That's cool. Well, listen, as we start to wrap up, I appreciate your time over here and the mini lecture we got started with then as well. The name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. So my questions I always ask everybody is, what's your philosophy of life?
Oh.
What's your magic word or phrase?
Oh, gee, my philosophy of life is love your audience. If you love your audience, they'll love you back.
Wow. Just come full circle. That's what we first started talking about. Excellent.
And as a codicil to that, I believe I was put on the face of this earth to make people happy. So anytime I see someone who is obviously unhappy, I try to make them smile or even laugh. And I start at the most basic element in our society, the Walmart cashier. Mm-hmm. When I see a lady at Walmart who's got a guy in the express line and he's got 40 items and they don't have UPC codes, I don't get out of the line. Instead, when I get up there, I'll say, take a deep breath, count to 10. I have good news for you. I have UPC codes on everything and I'm using a credit card.
Helped make her day, especially yes. for that former one. Okay. Oh, that's great. Well, Bill, thank you again very much for your time. Well, I wanted to thank you for your years of friendship and time that you've shared with me, and I've always enjoyed it. As I said, you know, we have a mutual thing that you'll do my broken wand if I go before you, and vice versa.
That's right, so. Exactly. And it's just that, you know, I remember the first time that we had a hospital room meeting.
Hell yeah.
You said, when they were going to work on my eye, you said, well, I hope everything comes out all right. And then you realized what that sounded like. And I said, that's fine, Scott. Be sure to come back. I'll keep an eye out for you.
That's what I remember. I'll keep an eye out for you. Love you, man. It's been great.
Same here.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Okay. So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Bill Palmer, and this is Scotty out. So I wanted to get Bill back for just a few moments because I noticed that as I was listening to our chat together that we forgot to talk about those three important words that many of you know him to be most famous for, and that is cups and balls. And so, Bill, I just wanted to ask you a couple of questions about, since you have moved from where you were and you no longer have the collection or the area, I guess, from what you had before, do you still have the collection intact someplace? Are there boxes, or what's the status of it currently?
Well, okay, here's my situation. I had roughly the floor space, but, you know, when you're talking about things that go on shelves, sometimes floor space is not as important as wall space. And the room that currently houses the Cups and Balls Museum has a cathedral ceiling, but the sides of the cathedral ceiling are only 6 feet high. So that means that I basically lose two sidewalls. Hmm. So, or I should say half of each of these walls, you know, so that cut my shelving space way down. I have a really weird shelf situation in there. I have low shelves on the sides, and then I have two rows of shelves that run at, let's say, one third of the way from the wall, and that they consist of two rather tall shelves back to back, so that there's still a lot of shelving in there, but it's really hard to see the cups. In the old display, even though I had the cups scattered, you know, set up three sets deep, you could pretty well see all of them. And this one, you can't do that. And it's just very inconvenient.
Right.
And I'm not really motivated to go in there and do much with them.
Well, one of the things is that I wanted to point out for those people who are listening to the podcast then now is that I posted a video on YouTube, which is available on the blog. So if you go to themagicwordpodcast.com, you can click on it there or find it through YouTube, Bill Palmer's Cups and Ball Collection that we recorded some years ago. And at that time, you said that you had about 600 sets. Now, here we are 11 years later, almost 12 years later, and I recall the last time we talked, you had well over 1,000. So how many did you have at the peak, and how many do you have now in your collection?
Well, it's still at the peak. Right now, it's over 1,800 sets.
Oh, wow.
I can't even tell you exactly how many because I did acquire a few sets after I moved.
Yeah,
I have a set of Paul Fox cups that were used by Paul Fox, or they were bought from his daughter, yeah, mm-hmm. from his daughter before she passed away. David Benn found them in the basement of Paul's workshop there. He found two cups in one place and one in the other. And they were a little different from a regular set of Paul Fox cups. So I asked David to compare notes with me, because I knew he had a set of those. You know, there were about a half dozen of those. And he said, yeah, his set's like that. So I said, okay, so I know what the original Paul Fox cups were like. And they are different. I mean, now I could, you know, if you know what to look for on almost anything, you can set whatever it is on a table, let's say 5 or 10 feet from somebody, and they can look at it and say, yeah, that's a set of those, or no, that's not a set of them, mm-hmm. whatever. It doesn't matter what it is, and as long as it's big enough that your eye can resolve what the object is, you can tell this because you know what to look for. And so that's something right. I learned. I also got some of the cups from the Dean Dill estate and so forth. I haven't been adding cups like I had in the past. I mean, there was a time when I was adding as many as 2 or 3 dozen sets of cups a week.
Wow.
And that's a lot of cups. Of course, some of them were what most people would basically call junk cups. They were what I call found cups. These are cups that you go over to Walmart or a party shop and you buy 3 cups in a certain theme that you can use for doing a party.
Yeah.
So then the purpose of that particular section of the museum was to show that you didn't have to spend $20 or $200 or $750 on a set of cups. You can go over to the Walmart and pick up some cups. You'd go over to Party City and pick up some cups.
Right.
And we could do a perfectly viable show with them.
Well, you know, I just saw on Facebook here recently, Tom Franks had posted a picture of some Danny Dew cups that had gone for about $2,500.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that they can be quite expensive.
Oh, yeah.
The Sherwood cups, for an example, they have, I know they're not available, but if they were, how much would a set of those go for, you think?
Oh, all the Sherwood cups are available except for the solid silver ones. I'm talking about the non-engraved ones. Hmm. You can pick up, Sherwood still makes all of those. The ones that are the rarest are the solid silver non-engraved cups, either unplated or with the gold wash on the inside, or with the gold plating. Those, there were only 10 sets of each, and, somebody asked me what they're worth, and I said, well, to tell you the truth, they're worth whatever the traffic will bear, and I'm not in a mood right now to part with any of mine, so I figure if I wanted to get rid of them, I'd probably want at least $2,500 a set for them. And he said, oh, well, I did okay because I didn't pay nearly that much for the set that I got. And I said, well, then you did. You know, it sounds like you made a good deal.
Yeah.
But, these are absolutely pristine cups, not even a scratch on them. I don't even think they have any fingerprints on them. I was that careful with them.
I know you have a lot of beautiful sets. And when we had the exhibit at the Natural History Museum or Natural Science Museum a few years ago here in Houston, that you brought out some of your cups and they put them in just an absolutely gorgeous display cases that you could walk around. There were glass encased and everything. You had some in the walls. And also that you showed the evolution kind of going back to some clay cups up through the current ones. That was a beautiful display. How did you go about trying to select which ones that were going to be your most beautiful babies to put in that collection?
Well, it was a cooperative effort. One of the ladies from the museum who was on the staff that selected all the stuff that went in the display selected several different sets, and then I made some suggestions once she came up with them. But we were both on the same page with things. We wanted stuff that would be appealing to the eye of the layman, and that was one of the reasons we got, for instance, the the cups that were made by the Italian fellow, the ones that came in that rather odd-looking treasure chest, which, right. by the way, was put together by Bob Little. It was not put together by Vittorio Valli. It was, which I thought was kind of funny, but, you know, that's the way things were. Bob used to do that with relatively inexpensive cups, you know, a set of $20 or $30 cups. He'd go out and find a treasure chest for them, and he'd right. pack the cup with some balls and some loads, and then he'd put a $250 price tag on them, and people would pay it. And, you know, if it was a, you know, it was a nice display thing.
Right.
But as far as what I'm going to be doing with the cups now, I know I've got a lot of stuff in there that is really, let's say, I'm not going to say it's not worth having. It just takes up a lot of space, and I'll probably get rid of most of that. Most of the paper cups will go. The only set I think I'll keep are the ones that Bob White used on his video. Mm-hmm. Let's see. I'll probably get rid of a lot of the plastic disposable cups. Although just out of tradition, I'll probably keep a set from the Wurst Fest, because that was one of the first places I saw where they had cups with shoulders on them that you could get with your beer. You know, and I probably picked up several sets of those when before I started collecting cups. But that, and then I'll probably get rid of the shell games. You know, a lot of us seem to think that the shell game and the cups and balls are really closely related, but they're not. I mean, the techniques are not that close.
Right.
You don't use the same kind of steels. You don't use the same kind of loads. And really, most guys who do the cups and balls don't have the, let's say, the ability to scam a spectator coldly. You know, they... I'm speaking now of average magicians. I'm not speaking of guys who are really, really solid cup workers like Gazzo or Cellini or somebody like that. But, mm-hmm. you know, the average magician, let's face it, he couldn't gamble his way out of a wet paper sack.
I understand.
Because he's scared to. He's scared to, you know.
Yeah.
He's the magician's guilt comes out and says, Hey, that lady looks like your mother, you know, that kind of thing. And that's yeah. why, we're just terrible gamblers.
Well, you know, at one point you were talking about wanting to donate your entire collection to a museum of the Texas Association of Magicians, and the TAOM had looked at a few different sites and fallen apart, and I guess that's not something that's going to happen at this point. So I'm sure that others have probably come to you and asked for donations, but you decided not to sell off or to give it away at this point?
Well, yeah, I'll tell you what happened. Originally, I was going, there was some talk about the SAM putting a Museum of Magic in Austin. And at that point, I was very open to the idea of donating the Cups and Balls Museum collection to the SAM. And you remember Kent Cummings came to that meeting
yeah.
and talked about it. And I made a cash donation, well, a check donation of $100 to the fund. This is even before they had the account set up. Kent mentioned this to me. He said, you know, we don't even have a bank account yet. But I said, well, that's okay. Don't worry about it. And then they had that convention in Dallas or in Arlington, what I think it was Arlington, where they were talking, a grapevine, where they were going to talk about the donations to the museum and so forth, and I was going to make a presentation about that to the board of directors meeting and so forth. And I get up there, and there's this portal, this doorway that's painted as a poster, and there's a list of all the people who donated money to this SAM museum, and my name was not on it.
Oops.
And I knew I'd made the first donation.
Yeah.
I was not a happy camper. And I mentioned this to, I guess it was either Ace or Jay Gorham, whichever one of them was the one that was in charge of all of them. I said, you know, this is kind of crappy. And he said, well, I don't have any record of this. And I said, well, I certainly do. And I said, you should talk to Kent Cummings. And so I went in and I said, I want to talk about donating my Cups and Balls collection to the SAM. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I did make the thing. This was when Bruce Calvert was just taking over the presidency. And I made the presentation. And it was like, you know, nobody even had any comprehension of what the scope of this was. And so I expected to hear something about it, and nothing ever happened. And then, of course, the whole thing fell apart, and the property in, I guess it was Louisville, became available. And I began to worry about whether that was going to happen. And then that didn't happen. And so I just said, hey, screw this. I'm not going to donate this to SAM. SAM, you know, fly a kite. And I explained this to Kent. And then I said, now, if you get something together for the TAOM, I'll do it. And so they started going back and forth on getting all this done. I think someone talked to Richard Garriott.
Right.
And someone talked to
Doc Seaton. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So there were several people who got talked to about this, and they were all very excited about it, but everybody kept dropping the ball, and finally I just got tired of it. And I said, I think it was Joe Valitti came up with the idea of let's each donate one of our favorite professional tricks to this and put out a book. And I thought, you know, why don't you just have a car wash? You know, and so I sent Joe an email, and he has one of these net nanny things on his account, and my email got bounced back to me, and so I sent the required permission granting thing to him to
it'd get through,
talk to him about it,
yeah.
And it bounced back. I thought, you know, this is really, really stupid. So I called Kent and I said, look, you guys can find a Cup and Paul collection somewhere else. I'm tired of fooling around with this. And that was the reason that the Cups and Balls collection became my albatross.
Yeah. So what about in your estate? Have you got something? I mean, eventually we're all going to die. Is there something that you have that you are thinking of, or have you got something in place to have something done with all this?
Yeah, well, I'll give you the answer I gave at the collectors, the last collector meeting, World 2. David Ben asked me, he said, so what are your plans now with the Cups and Balls collection when you pass away? I said, well, you know, they always say you can't take it with you. But I have decided that I'll just have the entire collection melted down into a casket. And he says, well, are you going to put a magnet in the lid so that you can have a secret
chop coffin?
Yeah, I said, you know, I think that's a good idea. And, of course, it was a joke, but, you know, it got a big laugh. And that was where I answered the three questions about collecting cups, which David had posed. I don't know if we talked about these, but these were the three key questions to collectors. Yeah. And David asked me to answer these three questions specifically. He said, the question one was, what makes a set of cups desirable? And I said, the answer is, you want them.
That's fair. I think that's just any kind of a person who collects art of any type. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, section question two is, what makes a set of cups collectible? Someone else wants them too.
Well, or that you already have two of a kind, and so you want a third. You know, it goes from an accumulation to and hoarding to a collection at some point.
if you're going to collect them, it makes it collectible is you want to do. Well, this the idea was people consider something collectible if people if more than one person wants them.
It's, yeah, you know, makes sense. Sure.
Usually it's a, and then the third question was, what set of cuffs should I buy for investment? And I said, find a set of cuffs in a solid gold box. <That's> Throw the cuffs away and keep the box.
And sell the box.
And I said, now, here is a fact about collecting. People who collect as an investment are doomed to be disappointed because you will never guess correctly on everything that you buy. If you're buying something simply to make the money from selling it, it's not going to work. There are a few exceptions. Sometimes land is a good investment. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes precious metals. Sometimes they're not. But by and large, if you collect things because you love them, you'll never be disappointed. And then when you sell them, you might be surprised. You might make a few bucks here and there on them.
That's a good point. And I've heard that very same line from Richard Hatch. Whenever I've looked at some books and I said, you think this is a good investment? He says, don't ever buy a book as an investment. If you buy it, it's because you want to know the contents, you want to hold it, you want to read it, you like it. And I also have a friend of mine who is a serious art collector. I mean, you know, with Picasso and Gauguin, and he's got a lot of the classics as well, and as well as certainly some of our contemporary artists today. And he said, I never buy things for investment purposes. I buy them because I like it. And just as you said, that Bill, if you sell it and you make some money, that's kind of a bonus. But in the meantime, you get to hold it and enjoy it. Well, listen, Bill, I want to thank you again. I wanted just to kind of tag this on the end of our podcast over here that we had talked so much about other kinds of important stuff and hadn't talked about cups and balls. And I thought, well, I know we're going to have some listeners who are going to be saying, he's the cups and ball guy. You know, you see the picture on the Magic Cafe, and he's got the cups and other places, certainly. So I just wanted to kind of touch base with you and kind of get this on the podcast then as well. So, again, thank you very much. And by the way, as a follow-up, too, when we were talking in the hospital, how's your health? Everything doing much better? You all doing?
Everything's going very well. They have been absolutely amazed at how quickly I recovered. In fact, they said this is the fastest recovery they've seen in the surgery ever. Of course, not having had a heart attack makes a big difference. I was going to add one other thing about collecting, though.
Yeah.
This is
okay.
There is a book that if you collect anything, I don't care if it's Pogs, hula hoops, Davy Crockett memorabilia, Disney stuff, Mattel, anything in the world, you've got to read the book. It's called Essay on Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds by Charles Mackay. It was written back in the 1700s, and it explains what makes things valuable. Essay on Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds by Charles Mackay, M-C-K-A-Y. You can look it up and get the exact title, but you can download the thing as a PDF. It's fascinating because people were investing in all sorts of stuff 200 years ago, and they were making megabucks off of them. Mm-hmm. And then someone says, you know, you can't eat this stuff. And they're going, huh? And the bottom fell out of the market. I mean, it's just little tidbits of information like that. So you just never know what's going to kill an investment.
You never know. You know, like baseball cards used to be just the hottest thing, and now no one goes to the baseball card convention like they used to. I mean, yeah, you can point to a lot of things, like you just pointed out there, the Pogs or whatever else. But, yeah, again, yeah, fodder for another conversation another time then, too. So, well, thank you. Thank you again, Bill.
You take care, Scott, and we have a happy holidays.
Thank you, and the same to you. And so for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Bill Palmer, and this is Scotty out.
Well, I found that conversation fascinating. I always enjoy talking with Bill, and I always come away having learned something when I spend some time with him as well. You know, I call this podcast Bill Palmer Renaissance Man, and it's not just because that he played Merlin in the Renaissance Festival, but it seems like any topic that I would discuss with him, whether it has to do with politics, with business, investing, buying a car, gosh, I don't know, whatever. You know, it seems like that he is the ultimate authority on it. And not from the standpoint that he's a know-it-all. It's just, to my way of thinking, he pretty much does know about everything. He just is wonderful as far as how the depth of his knowledge on so many things, as well as music, of course. And in fact, since he has retired pretty much from performing magic, that his real focus has been more on bluegrass. And he's been going to a lot of bluegrass festivals, which is why that you haven't seen or heard much of him as far as performing and seeing him at magic conventions or anything like that, because he's playing his banjo. And so anyhow, enjoys something else that, again, he knows a lot about. Quite an interesting wizard. So last week we had a contest that began running that offered an opportunity to win one of three different copies of a book that's offered by John Gaspard. It's called The Linking Rings. Now, as I mentioned in the podcast, that's not going to be physically available until I believe it's after January the 16th. So even if you order now on Amazon.com, that it would just be pre-ordered and then sent to you once that it becomes physically available. So I decided also I'm just going to let this contest run for another week. And so rather than drawing the names now, give an opportunity for those who may have missed entering the contest last week to have another full week of an opportunity to register for the contest. So I encourage you to go to themagicwordpodcast.com and look for last week's blog with John Gaspard, where that you can enter the contest for a chance to win one of three different copies of his book, The Linking Rings. Or if you want, you can also request one of his earlier books of the Eli Marks Mystery Series. Well, I mentioned earlier on the podcast that we've got some exciting guests that are going to be coming up, and this is number 398 that we're posting here right now with Bill Palmer, and next week will be 399, and my guest is going to be Mr. Anthony Owen. So we talked to him all the way across the pond, and he's got a lot of really interesting things to say, having to do with behind the scenes, basically, and working with Darren Brown and others in producing television and also stage theatrical shows like Darren's, and then the different tricks that he has come up with, etc. So anyhow, stay tuned for that next week. It's going to be really good, and that will be towards the end of the year. I believe that's going to be on the 29th of January when that gets released. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to love your audience, because if you do, they will love you back. Namaste. This is Scotty out.